Chapter 10 The Black Proletariat in South Carolina. How in the years from 1868 to 1876, in a state where blacks outnumbered whites, the will of the mass of black labor, modified by their own and other leaders, and dimmed by ignorance, inexperience, and uncertainty, dictated the form and methods of government. The record of the Negro worker during Reconstruction presents an opportunity to study inductively the Marxian theory of the state. I first called this chapter The Dictatorship of the Black Proletariat in South Carolina, but it has been brought to my attention that this would not be correct, since universal suffrage does not lead to a real dictatorship until workers use their votes consciously to rid themselves of the dominion of private capital. There are signs of such an object among South Carolina Negroes, but it was always coupled with the idea of that day that the only real escape for a laborer was himself to own capital. A great political scientist in one of the oldest and largest of American universities wrote and taught thousands of youths and readers that there is no question now that Congress did a monstrous thing and committed a great political error, if not a sin, in the creation of this new electorate. It was a great wrong to civilization to put the white race of the South under the domination of the Negro race. The claim that there is nothing in the color of the skin from the point of view of political ethics is a great sophism. A black skin means membership in a race of men which was never of itself succeeded in subjecting passion to reason, has never, therefore, created any civilization of any kind. Here is the crux of all national discussion and study of Reconstruction. The problem is incontinently put beyond investigation and historic proof by the dictum of Judge Taney, Andrew Johnson, John Burgess, and their conferrers, that Negroes are not men and cannot be regarded and treated as such. The student who would test this dictum by facts is faced by this set barrier. The whole history of Reconstruction has, with few exceptions, been written by passionate believers in the inferiority of the Negro. The whole body of facts concerning what the Negro actually said and did, how he worked, what he wanted, for whom he voted, is masked in such a cloud of charges, exaggeration, and biased testimony that most students have given up all attempt at new material or new evaluation of the old, and simply repeated perfunctorily all the current legends of black buffoons in legislature, golden spittoons for field hands, bribery and extravagance on an unheard-of scale, and the collapse of civilization until an outraged nation rose in wrath and ended the ridiculous travesty. And yet there are certain quite well-known facts that are irreconcilable with this theory of history. Civilization did not collapse in the South in 1868 through 1876. The charge of industrial anarchy is faced by the fact that the cotton crop had recovered by 1870, 5 years after the war, and by 1876, the agricultural and even commercial and industrial rebirth of the South was in sight. The public debt was large, but measured in depreciated currency and estimated with regard to war losses and the enlarged functions of a new society. It was not excessive. The legislation of this period was not bad, as is proven by the fact that it was retained for long periods after 1876, and much of it still stands. One must admit that generalizations of this sort are liable to wide error, but surely they can justifiably be balanced against the extreme charges of a history written for purposes of propaganda. And above all, no history is accurate, and no political science scientific that starts with the gratuitous assumption that the Negro race has been proven incapable of modern civilization. Such a dogma is simply the modern and American residue of a universal belief that most men are subnormal and that civilization is the gift of the chosen few. Since the beginning of time, most thinkers have believed that the vast majority of human beings are incorrigibly stupid and evil. The proportion of thinkers who believed this has naturally changed with historical evolution. In earliest times, all men but the chosen few were impossible. Before the middle class of France revolted, only the aristocracy of birth and knowledge could know and do. After the American experiment, a considerable number of thinkers conceived that possibly most men had capabilities, except, of course, Negroes. Possibly never in human history before or since have so many men believed in the manhood of so many men as after the Battle of Port Hudson, when Negroes fought for freedom. All men know that by sheer weight of physical force, the mass of men must, in the last resort, become the arbiters of human action. But reason, skill, wealth, machines, and power may for long periods enable the few to control the many. But to what end? The current theory of democracy is that dictatorship is a stopgap pending the work of universal education, equitable income, and strong character. But always, the temptation is to use the stopgap for narrower ends, because intelligence, thrift, and goodness seem so impossibly distant for most men. We rule by junta. We turn fascist, because we do not believe in men. Yet the basis of fact in this disbelief is incredibly narrow. We know perfectly well that most human beings have never had a decent human chance to be full men. Most of us may be convinced that even with opportunity, the number of utter human failures would be vast. And yet remember that this assumption kept the ancestors of present white America long in slavery and degradation. It is then one's moral duty to see that every human being, to the extent of his capacity, escapes ignorance, poverty, and crime. With this high ideal held unswervingly in view, monarchy, oligarchy, dictatorships may rule, but the end will be the rule of all, if, mayhap, all or most qualify. The only unforgivable sin is dictatorship for the benefit of fools, voluptuaries, gilded satraps, prostitutes, and idiots. The rule of the famished, unlettered, stinking mob is better than this, and the only inevitable logical and justifiable return. To escape from ultimate democracy is as impossible as it is for ignorant poverty and crime to rule forever. The opportunity to study a great human experiment was present in Reconstruction, and its careful scientific investigation would have thrown a world of light on human development and democratic government. The material today, however, is unfortunately difficult to find. Little effort has been made to preserve the records of Negro effort and speeches, actions, work and wages, homes and families. Nearly all this has gone down beneath a mass of ridicule and caricature, deliberate omission, and misstatement. No institution of learning has made any effort to explore or probe Reconstruction from the point of view of the laborer, and most men have written to explain and excuse the former slaveholder, the planter, the landholder, and the capitalist. The loss today is irreparable. And this present study limps and gropes in darkness, lacking most essentials to a complete picture. And yet the writer is convinced that this is the story of a normal working class movement, successful to an unusual degree, despite all disappointment and failure. South Carolina has always been pointed to as the typical Reconstruction state. It had, in 1860, 412,320 Negroes, and 291,300 whites. Even at the beginning of the 19th century, the 200,000 whites were matched by 150,000 Negroes, and the influx from the border and the direct African slave trade brought a mass of black slaves to support the new cotton kingdom. There had always been small numbers of free Negroes, a little over 3,000 at the beginning of the century, and nearly 10,000 in 1860. Slavery was the driving force of the state's industrial and social life. It was the institution which made South Carolina different from the states of the North. It was the principal reason why the white manhood of the state had fought so desperately. The economic loss which came through war was great, but not nearly as influential as the psychological change, the change in habit and thought. Imagine the 54th Massachusetts Colored Regiment heading the Union troops which entered Charleston and singing John Brown's Body. And Nun writes from that city concerning the changes which have come and which seem to her unspeakable. Could you but see these delicate ladies in houses void of furniture, reduced to the washtub and the cookpot, your heart would bleed. There were other Carolina women, not to be sure, ladies, to whom the chance to wash and cook for themselves spelled heaven in these days. The hatred of the Yankee was increased. The defeated Southern leaders were popular heroes. Numbers of Southerners planned to leave the country and go to South America or Mexico, and yet the slaveholders had not lost all by any means. There were 638 persons in South Carolina who were later pardoned by President Johnson because they had taxable property worth more than $20,000. They had their land, their tools, and while certain cities had been wrecked and pillaged, the great mass of the plantations had not been touched. The railroads had been injured, but not destroyed. Most of the 18 cotton factories were not touched. The labor situation, the prospect of free Negroes, caused great apprehension. It was accepted as absolutely true by most planters that the Negro could not and would not work without a white master. The nigger, sir, is a savage whom the Almighty Maker appointed to be a slave. A savage! With him free! The South is ruined, sir! Ruined! On the other hand, these apprehensions were not fulfilled. William Henry Trescott said, "When Negroes heard that freedom was coming, there was no impatience, no insubordination, no violence. They have received their freedom quietly and soberly. They remained pretty steadily on the farms of their masters, a very general disposition being manifest to adjust the terms of compensation on a reasonable basis." One great and real loss which the state suffered was the 12,922 men killed in battle and dead of wounds. Perhaps it can be concluded that the lack of distinctive achievements by South Carolinians since the war is in no small measure due to this loss. It was estimated by the census that land values declined 60% between 1860 and 1867, and that all farm property between 1860 and 1870 decreased from 169,738,630 to 47,628,175. In May 1865, a meeting was held in Charleston, and a committee was sent to talk with President Johnson. He asked them to submit a list of names from which he might elect a provisional governor, and he finally selected Benjamin F. Perry. This was, on the whole, an unfortunate selection. Perry was a devoted follower of Johnson and believed that Johnson had the power and backing to put his policies through. He immediately succeeded in having all Negro troops withdrawn, and he was certain that the North was with him and Johnson in standing for a purely white man's government. The Johnson Convention met and took some advanced steps. By a small majority, they did away with property qualifications for members of the legislature, but refused to count Negroes as bases of apportionment. This was a blow at the former slaveholders and a step toward democracy so far as the whites were concerned, but it was coupled with absolute refusal to recognize the Negroes. Perry insisted on letting property retain its right of representation in the legislature despite the opposition of President Johnson. The convention wanted to abolish slavery only on condition that Negroes be confined to manual labor and that slave owners be compensated. They were given to understand, however, that Johnson would not accept this, and they finally declared that since the slaves had been emancipated by the United States, slavery should not be re-established. In the elections for this convention, there was little interest. Only about one-third of the normal vote was cast on the coast, and inland, there were, in many cases, no elections at all. In the election which followed again, only 19,000 votes were cast. Ex-Governor Orr received a small majority and would have been beaten by Wade Hampton if Hampton had not refused the use of his name. Orr was a man of striking personality and had once been Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. The legislature, which met after this election, passed one of the most vicious of the black codes. It provided for corporal punishment, vagrancy, and apprenticeship laws, openly made the Negro an inferior caste, and provided special laws for his governing. Neither humanity nor expediency demanded such sharp distinctions between the races in opposing punishments. The restriction of Negro testimony to cases in which the race was involved was not common sense. The free admission of such testimony in all cases would not have involved the surrender of power by the whites, since they were to be the judges and jury. The occupational restrictions, instead of tending to restore order, created the impression that the dominant race desired to exclude the blacks from useful employment. It was impractical for a poverty-stricken commonwealth to have projected such elaborate schemes of judicial and military reorganization. There was increased difficulty in the economic situation. The war had ended late in the spring of 1865, so that the crops of that year were short, and there were crop failures for the next 2 years. All this complicated matters. In addition to this, the splendid start which the Negroes had on the lands of Port Royal and on the Sea Islands was interrupted. Johnson's Proclamation and Orders of 1865 provided for the early restoration of all property except property in slaves, and such of the Port Royal lands as had been sold for taxes. The landlords hurried to get their pardons and to take back their lands. The Negroes resisted sometimes with physical force. When some of the landlords visited Edisto Island, the Negroes told them, "You had better go back to Charleston and go to work there, and if you can do nothing else, you can pick oysters and earn your living." But these white men were not used to earning their own living. They were used to having Negroes do that for them, and now they had the federal government back of their claims. General Howard came down to facilitate the transfer and explained the condition to the Negroes. Still, the black folk were dissatisfied. They drew up a petition to President Johnson, asking for at least an acre and a half of land. The planters became overbearing and the Negroes angry. Saxton, who had placed them on the land, was dismissed, and Howard deprived of his power, so that finally, by federal force, Negroes were compelled to leave most of the lands and to make contracts as common laborers. The third Freedmen's Bureau Bill gave this the force of law. Thousands of Negroes migrated to Florida during 1866-1867 because of the land difficulties, the labor contracts, and the crop failures. 2,500 migrated to Liberia. Landholders used force, fraud, and boycott against farm labor. It was declared in 1868 that in South Carolina, the whites do not think it wrong to shoot, stab, or knock down Negroes on slight provocation. It is actually thought a great point among certain classes to be able to boast that one has killed or beaten a Negro. The following resolutions were passed at public meetings of planters in South Carolina. Resolved that if inconsistent with the views of the authorities to remove the military, we express the opinion that the plan of the military to compel the freedman to contract with his former owner, when desired by the latter, is wise, prudent, and absolutely necessary. Resolved that we, the planters of the district, pledge ourselves not to contract with any freedman unless he can produce a certificate of regular discharge from his former owner. Resolved that under no circumstances whatsoever will we rent land to any freedman, nor will we permit them to live on our premises as employees. In the Abbeville district of South Carolina, it was said, here a planter worked nearly 100 hands near Cokesburg, 10 of them on the South Carolina Railroad, for 6 months, the planter receiving their wages, and the remainder on his plantation, raising a crop of corn, wheat, rice, cotton, etc. After the crop was harvested, the laborers were brought to Charleston, where, being destitute, they had to be rationed by the government. After their arrival in this city, the planter distributed $50 among them. The largest amount anyone received was $1.25, and from that down to 50 cents, some receiving nothing. One pack of dry corn a week was the only ration furnished the farmhands. Meantime, the growth of sentiment in favor of Negro suffrage was quickened because of the action of South Carolina and other states. Chief Justice Chase visited the state and spoke to the Negroes. He said, "I believe there is not a member of the government who would not be pleased to see universal suffrage." The Negroes were already bestirring themselves. In May 1864, at Port Royal, they held a meeting which elected delegates to the National Union Convention, which was to be held in Baltimore in June. In November 1865, the colored people met at Zion Church, Charleston, and protested against the work of the convention and of the legislature. The legislature refused to receive this petition and determined to ignore the matter of Negro suffrage entirely. Orr attended the National Union Convention in Philadelphia in 1866 and advised the legislature to reject the 14th Amendment. This the legislature did, with only one negative vote in both houses. The military commanders under the Reconstruction legislation did much to abolish discrimination. One captain of a vessel was fined, who refused to allow a colored woman to ride as a first-class passenger. And General Canby, a Kentuckian, whom Johnson appointed in March 1867, ordered that Negroes serve on juries. This led to excitement and protests. Northern capitalists began to appear in the state. They were, at first, welcomed. Men of capital are coming from the North by every steamer in view of investing in cotton and rice. We are glad to see such a lively trade in South Carolina. It benefits everyone. Later, and especially when they began to take part in politics, they were loaded with every accusation. Some of them were army officers, others employees of the Freedmen's Bureau. Some were farmers, and some religious and educational leaders. The Negroes naturally turned to them for leadership and received it. They helped organize the Negroes in union leagues in order to teach them citizenship and united action. Northern visitors continued to come. Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts spoke at Charleston. After 4 bloody years, liberty triumphed and slavery has died to rise no more. The creed of equal rights, equal privileges, and equal immunities for all men in America is hereafter to be the practical policy of the Republic. Never vote unless you vote for the country which made you free. Register your names. Vote for a united country. Vote for the old flag. Vote for a change in the Constitution of the state that your liberties may be consummated. Under the Reconstruction Law of 1867, 46,882 whites and 80,550 blacks voted. The planter class refrained from participation and hoped that the scheme would fail. In 10 of the 31 counties, there were white majorities, and in the remaining 21 counties, black majorities. Party conventions began to meet. The first one was that of the Union Republican Party, which met in Charleston, with 9 county representatives. It adjourned to Columbia, where 19 counties were represented. It was attended by colored and white men, including some southern men like Thomas J. Robertson, a wealthy native. The reaction among the whites led to 3 parties. Governor Orr and his party accepted the Reconstruction Acts and planned to work with the Negroes. Wade Hampton proposed to accept the acts, but only with the idea of finally dominating the Negro vote and having Negroes follow the lead of their former masters. Hampton owned large plantations in South Carolina and Mississippi. The New York Herald summarized his views as follows. He appeals to the blacks, lately his slaves, as his political superiors, to try the political experiment of harmonizing with their late white masters before going into the political service of strangers. The broad fact that the two races in the South must henceforth harmonize on a political basis to avoid a bloody conflict is the ground covered by Wade Hampton. A third party was led by former Governor Perry and Thomas W. Woodward. Strange to say, wrote Perry, there are many persons in the southern states whose high sense of honor would not let them adopt the 14th Amendment, who are now urging the people to swallow voluntarily the military bill, regardless of honor, principle, or consistency. If the state were forced to acquiesce in the tyranny of Congress, he added, she need not embrace the hideous thing. If we are to wear manacles, let them be put on by our tyrants, not ourselves. He argued the folly of attempting to control the Negro vote. General Hampton and his friends, he asserted, had just as well tried to control a herd of wild buffaloes as the Negro vote. Woodward was violent in denouncing the compromisers. Why? Oh! Why, my southern Negro worshippers, he cried, will you grope your way through this worse than Egyptian darkness? Why not cease this crawling on your bellies and assume the upright form of men? Stop, I pray you, your efforts at harmony, your advice about conventions, your pusillanimous insinuations about confiscations, etc., or you will goad these people by flattery to destruction before they have a chance to pick out the cotton crop. Perry proposed to appeal to the courts and advised the whites to register and vote against the Constitutional Convention. The Convention of Whites was held a week before the Constitutional Convention, with 21 of the 31 districts represented. This convention made cooperation on the part of Negroes of any intelligence utterly impossible. It declared, the fact is patent to all, that the Negro is utterly unfitted to exercise the highest functions of a citizen. We protest against this subversion of the social order, whereby an ignorant and depraved race is placed in power and influence above the virtuous, the educated, and the refined. The nation was informed that the white people of South Carolina would never acquiesce in Negro equality or supremacy. The president of the convention complained that the declarations were filled with adjectives and epithets, which put a weapon in the hands of the enemies of the movement. The state convention, when it met, had Negro members for the first time in the history of the state. 76 of the 124 delegates were colored. As in Mississippi and elsewhere, a number of the planter class had early contemplated an effort to control the Negro vote and thus quickly to get rid of military rule. On the other hand, the Negroes, because of the educated free Negro element, some considerable talent among the slaves, and the influx of Negroes from the North, showed unusual foresight and modesty. The convention was earnest, and on the whole, well conducted. Of the 76 colored men, it is said 57 had been slaves. The native whites felt, said the correspondent of the New York Times, that the destinies of the state were safer in the hands of the unlettered Ethiopians than in those of the whites of the body. Beyond all question was the effusive comment of the Charleston Daily News, the best men in the convention are the colored members. Considering the influences under which they were called together and their imperfect acquaintance with parliamentary law, they have displayed, for the most part, remarkable moderation and dignity, They have assembled neither to pull wires, like some, nor to make money like others, but to legislate for the welfare of the race to which they belong. There were 27 Southern white members of the convention, some of them honest and earnest, and some of them with questionable antecedents. One of them had made up a purse to buy a cane for Brooks after he had assaulted Sumner. Another had assisted in hauling down the Union flag from Fort Sumter. A third had been a slave trader. Among the Northerners were colored and white men of education and character, as well as some adventurers. To the chagrin of many white onlookers, the convention was not a disorderly group. The delegates did not create the Negro bedlam which tradition has associated with them. President Mackey said that he had no unpleasant reminiscences of those acrimonious bickerings which, in all deliberative assemblies, are often incidental to the excitement of debate and the attrition of antagonistic minds. There was no tendency to insult the white South, and even deference was paid to the defeated Confederate soldiers. This was in striking contrast to the wild and unscrupulous attacks made by the press upon this convention. Some called the experiment the maddest, most unscrupulous, and infamous revolution in history, and said that it was snatching power from the hands of the race that settled the country and transferring it to its former slaves, an ignorant and feeble race. The representative of one paper was expelled from the floor for sneering at the ringed, striped, and streaked convention. Other papers received all possible courtesies. The real basis of opposition to the new regime was economic. Nothing showed this clearer than one fact, and that is that the chief and repeated accusations against the convention and succeeding legislatures was that they were composed of poor men, white and black. The white 47 delegates were said to have paid altogether $761 in annual taxes, of which one conservative paid $508. The total taxes paid by the 74 Negroes were $117, of which a Charleston Negro paid $85. 23 of the whites and 59 of the colored paid no taxes whatever. In a day when property was sacred, no matter how secured, and in a state where it had been politically supreme, this attitude was understandable. Yet one wonders just what was expected. Since the great majority of the white people of the state had been kept in ignorance and poverty, and practically all of the Negroes were slaves, whose education was a penal offense, one would hardly expect universal suffrage to put rich men in the legislature. It was singularly to the credit of these voters that poverty was so well represented. It showed certain tendencies toward a dictatorship of the proletariat. The Taxpayers' Convention of 1871 frankly proposed to restore the power of property by giving 60,000 taxpayers voting power equal to 90,000 non-taxpayers. What was the black man thinking and saying in these days? There was abundant evidence of clear and logical thought among his leaders. The South Carolina Negroes approached their new responsibilities with a due sense of difficulty and responsibility. Beverly Nash, a black ex-slave and member of the Constitutional Convention, born in slavery, said, "I believe, my friends and fellow citizens, we are not prepared for this suffrage, but we can learn. Give a man tools and let him commence to use them, and in time he will learn a trade. So it is with voting. We may not understand it at the start, but in time we shall learn to do our duty. We recognize the Southern white man as the true friend of the black man. You see upon that banner the words, 'United we stand, divided we fall.' And if you could see the scroll of the society that banner represents, you would see the white man and the black man standing with their arms locked together as the type of friendship and the union which we desire. It is not our desire to be a discordant element in the community or to unite the poor against the rich. The white man has the land. The black man has the labor. And labor is worth nothing without capital. We must help to create that capital by restoring confidence. And we can only secure confidence by electing proper men to fill our public offices. In these public affairs, we must unite with our white fellow citizens. They tell us that they have been disfranchised. Yet we tell the North that we shall never let the halls of Congress be silent until we remove that disability. Can we afford to lose from the councils of state our first men? Can we spare judges from the bench? Can we put fools or strangers in their positions? No, fellow citizens, no. Gloomy indeed would be that day. We want in charge of our interest only our best and ablest men. And then with a strong pull and a long pull and a pull together, up goes South Carolina. Both Sumner and Stevens had encouraged the Negroes of South Carolina to seek sympathetic Southern whites as their leaders, but neither they nor others suggested any plans of union with white labor. White Carolina labor was dumb, with absolutely no intelligent leadership except the planters and carpetbaggers. When the convention opened, ex-Governor Orr was invited to address them. In his speech, he stressed the fact that the freedmen needed education and that they did not represent the intelligence nor wealth of the state, and he recommended limited suffrage, a homestead law, and education. The plight of debtors after the losses and changes of war brought much debate in the Constitutional Convention. A white delegate advocated a 3 months moratorium on debt collections, and a colored member supported the proposal. But Cardozo, a colored man, and later the treasurer of the state, said, "I am opposed to the passage of this resolution. The convention should be certain of the constitutionality of their acts. The law of the United States does not allow a state to pass a law impairing the obligations of contracts. This, I think, is therefore a proper subject for the judiciary. I am heartily in favor of relief, but I wish the convention to have nothing to do with the matter." R. G. DeLarge, a colored delegate, afterward land commissioner, said, "It has been said in opposition to this measure that the proposed legislation was for a certain class. However, no gentleman can rise and argue that the proposed measure is for the benefit of any specific class. I hold in my hands letters from almost every section of the state addressed to members of the convention crying out for relief. These letters depict in strong language the impoverished condition of the people and demand that something should be done to relieve them. I deny in toto that this is a piece of class legislation, and I believe nothing but the zeal of the members who spoke yesterday induced them to speak of it as such. It is simply a request to General Canby to relieve the necessities of a large part of the people of the state. Some members have gone farther and said it was a shame to keep the freedmen from becoming purchasers and owners of land. It has been argued that the execution of the laws compelling the sale of the lands will benefit the poor man by affording him an opportunity to get possession of the lands. That argument, I am confident, cannot be sustained. If they are sold, they will be sold at public sale and sold in immense tracts, just as they are at present. They will pass into the hands of the merciless speculators who will never allow the poor man to get an inch without first drawing his life's blood in payment. The poor freedmen are the poorest of the poor and unprepared to purchase lands. The poor whites are not in condition to purchase lands. The facts are The poor class are clamoring, and their voices have been voiced far beyond the limits of South Carolina, away to the seat of the government, appealing for assistance and relief from actual starvation. The problem of the land came in for early consideration. The landless, it was felt, should be aided in the acquirement of property, and the landed aristocracy discriminated against. It was proposed that Congress be petitioned to lend the state $1 million to be used in the purchase of land for the colored people, that the legislature be required to appoint a land commission, and that homesteads up to a certain value be exempt from the levy of processes. One must view this action in light of what had taken place with regard to land in South Carolina. When Northern forces captured Port Royal in November 1861, the federal authorities took over 195 plantations and employed over 10,000 former slaves in raising cotton. Early in 1862, they imported labor superintendents from the North and organized the enterprise. In July 1862, Congress laid a direct tax on the land of the states in rebellion. When the absentee landholders of Port Royal failed to pay, their plantations were sold at public auction to satisfy a part of the debt of $363,570 which had been imposed upon South Carolina. Considerable other property, which was regarded as abandoned, was seized in Charleston. The lands that were auctioned off were bought largely by Northerners, although a few Negroes who had got hold of a little money from their labor bought certain plantations. On January 16, 1868, General Sherman issued his celebrated Field Order No. 15. All the sea islands, from Charleston to Port Royal and adjoining lands to the distance of 30 miles inland, were set aside for the use of the Negroes who had followed his army. General Saxton executed this order and divided 485,000 acres of land among 40,000 Negroes. They were given, however, only possessory titles, and in the end, the government broke its implied promise and drove them off the land. In the convention, the whole matter of land for the landless came up for considerable debate. Cardozo said that he did not believe in the confiscation of property, but since slavery was gone, the plantation system must go with it. Whipper, another colored man, was more inclined to protect the interests of the planters and reminded the members that they were representatives of all classes in the community and not simply of a particular class. This debate on the economic situation was prolonged. All contracts and liabilities for the purchase of slaves, where the money had not yet been paid, were annulled. J.J. Wright, colored, and later a state Supreme Court judge, said of this measure, "I know it is said by our opponents that we are an unlawful assembly and that we are an unconstitutional body. I know we are here under the laws of Congress, lawfully called together for the discharge of certain duties and the repudiation of debts contracted for slaves. It is the duty of the convention to do what? It is our duty to destroy all elements of the institution of slavery. If we do not, we recognize the right of property in man." A homestead law to the value of $1,000 in real estate and $500 in personal property was passed. Rainey declared that Congress would probably never pass an act confiscating the land, but the other colored members, including Ransier, wanted to petition Congress for a loan of $1 million to purchase land. A colored delegate said on this matter, "My colleague presented a petition asking the Congress of the United States to appropriate $1 million for a specific purpose, to purchase homesteads for the people of South Carolina, not the colored people, as the gentleman from Barnwell has attempted to prove, but to all, irrespective of color." He has also attempted to prove that the money cannot be obtained, but has failed to carry conviction to the minds of any of the members. There is plenty of land in the state that can be purchased for $2 an acre, and $1 million will buy us 500,000 acres. Cut this into small farms of 20 acres, and we have 25,000 farms. averaging 7 persons to a family, that 20 acres can sustain, and we have 175,000 persons, men, women, and children, who for $1 million will be furnished means of support. That is, 1/4 of the entire people of the state. Mr. R.C. DeLarge, colored, continued on the same subject. There are over 1,000 freedmen in this state who, within the last year, purchased lands from the native whites on the same terms. We propose that the government should aid us in the purchase of more lands, to be divided into small tracts and given on the above-mentioned credit to homeless families to cultivate for their support. It is well known that in every district the freedmen are roaming from one side to the other, not because they expect to get land, but because the large landholders are not able to employ them and will not sell their lands unless the freedmen have the cash to pay for them. These are facts that cannot be contradicted by the gentleman from Barnwell. I know one large landholder in Colleton District who had 21 freedmen working for him upon his plantation the entire year. He raised a good crop, but the laborers have not succeeded in getting any reimbursement for their labor. They are now roaming Charleston and back, trying to get remuneration for their services. We propose to give them lands and to place them in a position by which they will be enabled to sustain themselves. In doing this, we will aid to the depleted treasury of the state, and the large plantation system of the country will be broken up. The large plantation will be divided into small farms, giving support to more people and yielding more taxes to the state. It will bring out the whole resources of the state. I desire it to be distinctly understood that I do not advocate this measure simply for the benefit of my own race.